You remember the scene in Jurassic Park where the blood-sucking lawyer runs into the toilet to hide from the recently escaped T-Rex, only to get torn apart like a fresh burrata moments later? Well, that's precisely how I, and most of the men in my life, dealt with mental illness. Run away, surround ourselves with a flimsy wooden shack of protection, and have it destroyed by the very thing we were running from. Dinosaurs may be dangerous, but your mental health is a stealthier and sneakier little sausage. Trust me, remaining very still is quite honestly the shittest option for dealing with it. And I learned that the hard way. Campfire was created so that men everywhere no longer have to suffer in silence, and we can feel confident to reach out when we're feeling like we're getting relentlessly fucked by that little thing called life. The recipe is simple. Big, bold, ballsy conversations with brave, brilliant bros. Vulnerable as fuck, with no apology or awkwardness. Campfire is about tapping into what really makes us tick. So, strap in, sit back, and get ready for some chats that aim to redefine what it means to be a man in 2021. Let's get it! Again. What is up, my dudes? Hope you're well. My name is Bobby O, and I am the captain of courage, the talisman of talking, the vivifier of vulnerability. This week, we're going to meet someone that I've looked forward to having on the podcast for some time, South African rugby player, Mr. Skulk Brits.
Here are the Skulk facts.
Born in Empangeni, South Africa, Skulk Brits, or Skulk Burger Brits if you want to get technical, is a human gentleman. And that, my friends, is just for starters. His early years in rugby during the front end of the 2000s saw him charging around dismantling teams that came up against his first two clubs, the Stormers and the Lions, in the Super Rugby League. Then, in 2009, Brits made the switch to Saracens and quickly became an integral part of a very successful team, where he helped propel them to a Premiership final in his first year. Despite losing that final to Leicester, he was rewarded with the Rugby Players Association Players Player of the Year Award and a nomination for the Premiership Player of the Year Award. After 9 seasons, 4 Premierships and 2 European Cups with Saracens, Skulk was ready to hang up his boots in 2018. But fate had other plans. As you will hear in our chat, a surprise phone call had called Skulk back to the international stage, and after thinking his playing days were done, he became a key component of the South African World Cup winning squad in 2019. During our discussion, we touch upon why it's important to wear your vulnerability like a coat of armour, not cracking under the weight of your own talents or ego, and, more importantly, difficult South African name pronunciations. As always, I'll be back at the end to talk waffle about reviews, support and further help. But without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please warm up your ear holes in preparation for the man that needs no introduction, Mr. Skulk Brits.
Hello, matey. How are you?
Mate, I'm so good. And even though it's late, like it's 9 p.m. here, and normally yeah. I would be sound asleep. I'm getting old.
At 9? Mate. You are getting old if you go to bed at 9.
Now, one thing, right, before we start, hang on.
Yeah.
Speak of the devil, yeah. That was my sister.
Say hi.
I'm going to get rid of her.
Did she want to know if I'm on the call?
Well, I messaged her last week and I was like, he's getting a haircut. She was like, yeah, that sounds like him.
Shit, sorry.
No apologies. No apologies. You are all good, sir. I'm just going to get this up because my colleague is South African. She's like, who are you interviewing? It's like, Skulk Brits. And she's going, I don't think you pronounce it like that. So I said, this is our conversation.
Yeah.
How do you pronounce his name?
Skulk.
Thanks.
So I believe the pronunciation is Skulk. Can you confirm that?
Rob, that's definitely the right way to pronounce it. But I was Skulk for 9.5 years in London. So I've
yeah, I would have thought.
I mean, I was called Schlack. So I won award even called Schlack Rock. So, I mean, I'm taking Schalk anytime, every day.
I think out of respect, I'll try and aim for Skulk. Is that right? Skulk?
Yeah, Skulk.
It's a great Skulk name. It's a great name. In fact, I don't know what's going on. My colleague just messaged me then. She must have, all these people must just have a sixth sense for for you. So, yeah. Hi. This is great, by the way.
Hi.
I'm going to try not to fanboy too much because Fiona may or may not have told you, but yeah, we grew up in a very rugby orientated city, Worcester, whom I'm sure you played against with your time in the UK. But welcome, Schalk. Skulk? Oh, I'll start again. I've ruined your name already. I'm embarrassed.
It's actually great to start this way.
I have literally been practicing that in my head all day. I was like, don't say Schalk. It's not Schalk. It's Skulk. Say it properly. If you're going to do it properly. Okay. Tegan is going to be so upset with me as well. She was like, now make sure you get it right. It's important. Okay. So, Skulk, welcome to the warmth of Campfire Conversations. As you know, I've set out to take an ambitious swing at redefining what masculinity looks like and to propose that being in touch with your emotions doesn't make you a giant puss-puss. During these chats, hit in the hot, uncomfortable, often awkward hot tub of men's... I'll start again. During these chats, I want to sit in the hot, uncomfortable, often awkward hot tub of men's emotions, and with any luck, it might encourage others to do the same. But before we discard our fearless frontage and furrow deep into what makes us tick, how are you?
I am actually phenomenal. I'm chilling and chatting to you, looking forward to the next... whatever time or how long we'll waffle on, but I'm looking forward to opening up and sitting in the hot tub with you and sharing some very intimate stories.
Well, I would love that. And so talk to me. I mean, you say you're phenomenal. Talk to me about why you're phenomenal. Yeah. Like 2020 has been a really bizarre, weird and wonderful year. And from a personal point of view, very oddly, I don't know.
Yeah.
If you know, like last year was an absolute write-off for me. But this year, oddly, I seem to have had a much more productive year. Tell me about your 2020.
Well, firstly, I retired from rugby at the end of 2019 off the World Cup. And then I started a new career at Remgro. But, I mean, nobody expected COVID. We heard about this funny disease or thing coming from China. And for me personally, I can either look at it from a positive or negative perspective. From a growth perspective in my work, it's been challenging. First of all, you know, the culture is different. I'm going from a rugby culture to a financial culture, financial services culture, working at Remgro, now in Venfin, that in the VC space or venture capital space. But from a personal perspective, you know, I've got three boys, 8, 6, and 4. Christian, Hunt, and Luke. And lastly, I've only spent the last 8 months, 15 days at home. So for me, it's amazing spending time at home with my family, with my wife, and doing things that I couldn't do for the last 20 years, really. We've been in South Africa. I embraced change and change for good. And for me, it's been amazing. I'm totally out of my depth, although I'm standing at the office now. You know, technically, I've got, although I studied accountancy, I couldn't remember what I studied, 15 years ago. So I'm learning on the go. But one good thing is the people is amazing. And first of all, if you surround yourself with good people, good things will happen. And I really believe that. And it's, for me, it's how I treat them and how they treat me.
Well, I love that, mate. And I love to hear you coming into this so positively. I love to hear that people are having, in spite of what's happening on a global scale, it's wonderful to hear that you're so positive and that you can take really amazing things out of the last 12 months, because it's been rather curious. Now, You did kind of gloss over that you played rugby, and I think it's important to just touch upon that ever so slightly, as I'm sat here being like a Cheshire Cat, because I obviously know you, being a bit of a rugby fan. So for those who don't know you, the headline here is that you are a seasoned rugby player. As hooker, you played at home.
Does that mean he's old?
I mean, seasoned as in experienced, sir. Experienced. Now, you've played at home in South Africa, you've played in New Zealand, then in the UK, and you enjoyed enormous success throughout your career, which culminated, as you said, in the 2019 World Cup victory for your country. However, Now get ready for this seamless segue, Skulk. It's balls of a different nature that we're going to focus on today. That is the ones between our legs.
Yes.
Right. That was good, right?
Good.
Now, as much as the rugby nerd wants me to drill into your playing time, it's also more about how you felt during this period that I want to tuck into. So... Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about, I guess, what would be really interesting is you've obviously dealt with the pressures of a professional career in sport. And I wonder if you could talk to me a little bit about that and how you dealt with that and, you know, when times were tough.
Yeah. So how can we start? Let's start from an early age. People will normally when you get to know me well, and the facade outside Skulk is I always see a funny, laughing guy enjoying rugby. And you must always go into essence, why do you enjoy rugby? Why do I enjoy life? And it's actually just a mental state of how you put things together. And especially for, I can remember I was under 16, or this is now 15 years old, playing rugby. And I was coming off the pitch and it was a bad day. We lost. And my dad asked me, why do you play rugby? I said, because I enjoy it. He looked at me and said, well, it doesn't look like you're enjoying it, Skulk. You're here to enjoy things. Rather go surf or do something else. And that sort of changed my mind from a rugby perspective. So for me, I do things, and what I do now is I enjoy what I'm doing. I'm learning. Rugby-wise, I was always... I could never lose, although I can lose a match, I could never lose. The only thing I can lose is respect from my fellow teammates and opposition. So for me, it's always going on the pitch, I'll try to earn respect. The only way you can lose is by not trying. If I lose, or if as a team we lost against a great side, then we'll go, okay, well, what can we learn from them? How can we get better? But that mentality wasn't always there. That was only sort of, formed when I went to Saracens. But before that, when I played for the Springboks before 09 and for the Stormers and Lions, it was always about winning. And people always want to win. But you don't always understand or know the process into what it takes to win, really. You know, nobody wants to be a loser. Everyone wants to be a winner. But then, you know, you grow as a team and as an individual a lot more from losing. The only time you lose if you make the same mistakes constantly. If you can actually see it as a growth. And there's a great book about Matthew Saeed, Black Box Thinking, where if you embrace failure, not to say that you want to lose all the time, but if you embrace change, embrace failure, and actually learn and improvise, then actually it's a great way of going forward. And for me, I never saw rugby as a profession. I saw it as I'm getting paid to do something that I love doing. I mean, it is crazy. I play rugby from the age of 5, and they started paying me at 17 to do something I love. I mean, I couldn't be more fortunate.
One of the things you touched upon there was this idea of winning at all costs until you got to a certain point of your career. What was the catalyst for you to be able to say, like, the ego must play such a massive role in being the top of your game, but how do you manage that? How do you make sure that you don't buy into all your bullshit and you let that ego monster just take over? Like, you are obviously a phenomenal talent. Like, I remember seeing you play for Saracens. I saw you obviously last year in the World Cup. How do you not just suddenly get overwhelmed and go, yeah, I'm pretty good? What was it when you went to Saracens that really helped?
I'm brilliant. you do say you're pretty gifted, but luckily I had family and friends that kept me extremely humble. They didn't buy into this all "you're so good" kind of nonsense. If I got out of line, they told me, you know. And it's always, for me, it's great. I've still got uni friends, school friends, and I've got a very close relationship with my parents. So I don't have any siblings, but my friends kept me humble. And for me, what's amazing about the human race, everyone is gifted in a different way. And for me, my gift was playing rugby. Or someone else's gift is playing games or coding or doing something totally different. And for me, I don't see my gift as any better as the lady sitting right there. For me, it's different. The one is in the public eye, the one isn't. And for me, it's just purely from that perspective. Why should I value my importance more than the lady cleaning this place? It's how she treats me and how I treat her that actually earns respect, Rob. So it's got nothing to do about talents or how many followers you've got on Instagram or Twitter. I mean, it's in essence, people remember how you treat them, not what you've normally said or what you've done, but how you treat people.
That is very poignant. There is a meme that does the rounds of Tom Hardy shaking a homeless guy's hand just before he gets into a car with the very same sentiment. And I'm always like, yes, it's so important. How you are perceived, your impression that you put out to the world is so much more important. Yeah. You know, what's the lasting impression that you want people to have of you? I love that, mate. I think that's such a good way to apply yourself. Now, in terms of... I remember reading an article. This would have been nearly 2 years old now. But when you were, I think you were sat on a beach somewhere, and you got the call up to come back into the South Africa side for the World Cup. Talk to me a little bit how you were feeling with regards to your career at that point, and then how you transitioned back into the side, and how you felt since the end of the playing days.
Okay, phase one, retired after winning the Premiership with Saracens, sitting on a beach. That specific time we were in Ibiza celebrating, sort of as a family, the career in London, enjoying. Rugby, you know, it's just like the end of a chapter. And of course, I don't know how many listeners has got three kids. And it was actually quite late at night, drinking mojitos with the missus. The kids were in bed. And my wife would hate this, me saying this openly. And I was just, like most men, trying to connect with my wife and then get lucky, hopefully, late in the evening. And and then Rob, I got a text message from an unknown number, sort of asking if I want to be back in the game. And the end off was just Russ, short for Russie. I thought it was, of course, Vincent Koch in South Africa, having a couple of beers and playing a practical joke on me, or prank. And then after, like, he said, am I keen? So Russie sends a message, am I keen to get back into it and have another go. And I sent back, yes, of course, I'm the prettiest, biggest, smartest, biggest, quickest, strongest hooker ever. Now, I'm taking the mickey after like 3 or 4 text messages. My wife, the solicitor she is, she goes, always conservative, aren't you sure it's Rassi? So, of course, I think, no, there's no chance it's Rassi. Who wants the, what's it then, 38-year-old rugby player to get play for the Springboks? I couldn't make the Springboks half of my life, and now someone's asking me at 38 to join.
Yeah, yeah.
So the weirdest thing is then you're phoned eventually, and there Rassi answers, and yes, I'm back in the mix. So I had to ask my wife first if they would make another sacrifice for another year or 18 months with my boys, of course. So it's a family effort. From that perspective, they said it's all good. Then I had to ask Remgro, the company that I work for now, and all in Benfant, if they would mind waiting. And Johan Rupert actually just said, listen, Scala, what's the difference if you start working for me at 37 or 38? So I got the blessing of Remgro to postpone that. And then I phoned Cambridge and they said I can postpone my studies for another year. So everything fell into place.
Yeah, so amazing.
Yeah, so it was all, that's a short version of it. And then, you know, I had to still perform to a decent level to make the Springboks squad. It was a risk I took, but I still felt good. I still felt I was hitting the markers from a physical, from a fitness perspective and from a strength perspective, and I enjoy rugby. And it's the most difficult thing as a professional sportsman is to know when to retire. You know, you don't want to be the fart that stays on and said he should have retired 5 years ago, or be the guy that never got the opportunity to fulfill his career. So it's a fine balance between getting the timing right. As I'm standing here now, 10 kilograms lighter, I still feel I can, you know, dance with the rugby players, but, you know, there's a time to say hello and there's a time to say goodbye kind of thing. So, yeah, so that is how I ended up in the Springbok setup. Played for the Bulls. That's why I was away from home quite a bit. And then, of course, the World Cup. And I'm actually based in Cape Town, where the Bulls are based in Pretoria. But they were so accommodating. I flew up on Monday mornings, back on Wednesdays, up on Thursday, you know, back on Saturdays kind of thing. So, yeah, everybody accommodated, myself and Dwayne Vermeulen, quite a bit.
Yeah, that's great. And so during that period of time, I mean, especially just thinking about how you've dealt with a life in the public eye, you know, we spoke about just that, managing that ego and dealing with all the personal things that you've gone through, but making sure that the body feels right, making sure the mind feels right. Have you got a process for doing that? Or have you just been fortuitous enough to just keep, like, for people listening, obviously they would love to know about ways in which, you know, someone who is at arguably the top of their game, and as you say, like, still considers themselves to be on top of their game, like, what is it you've done and what is it you've managed to use in your as part of your skill set and your toolkit to keep yourself from, you know, crap mental health?
Well, there's always doubt, Rob, about your personality, your I guess that's a human trade. But from a public perspective, the first question is, how do I manage from a public eye and being in the public? It's actually the biggest adjustment is normally kids and wife and friends, because if you go for dinner or lunch, people ask for signatures or come say hi and talk a bit of give you a bit of banter about rugby or life in general. So that always sort of has an impact in your private life. So you know, when you're at home, it's fantastic. If you go out, you know, your time is not yours before it. So that's quite a mental shift. And with time, you understand the requirements of being in the public eye. From a physical perspective and from a mental perspective, you know, I never saw, maybe because rugby wasn't everything. It's never been everything and won't ever be everything. You know, for me, it was always a part. It doesn't define who I am. It doesn't make me a better or worse person if I play well or bad. Although, you know, from a supporter's perspective, you'll get a lot of grief on social media. And luckily, when I started my career, I didn't have those pressures. Now, when I was younger, if you play a bad game, someone would shout something from the stands, you know. And now people can actually get access to you by social media. And I can see from a younger player perspective that that can have an impact. If people can communicate via Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook directly, or TikTok, or whatever it might be, that can have an impact. And it's quite hard. As a younger player, I tried to stay away from all media clippings while I was playing, because it's an opinion of someone, rightly or wrongly, that can have an impact on my well-being. So the guys that I look after to in respect is not the public eye, but it's my coaches and my players next to me, because next weekend I have to play against them again. So from that perspective, that's how I try to manage my physical, or more my mental health. You know, and I always had a dad that, and a mom that I can speak to, irrelevant. And luckily I married someone that does not watch rugby. She's she was born in South Africa, but her parents is Dutch. She barely watched rugby when she grew up. From that perspective, it was quite a nice balancing act. That is sort of physical. And from a physical perspective, you know, I wish, and this is what I can say now, I wish I worked harder, especially at a younger age, to be a better rugby player. You know, sometimes at a younger age, I was studying, then trying to do rugby and then the social life. You know, it's for me, it's always about balance. So probably I would have been a better rugby player if I worked harder. And in hindsight, I wish I did, because I really only understood hard work when I moved to Saracens at 29. You know, and so that, if I would say that is a regret, I do not regret anything. From a memory perspective, I had the best memories at Saracens. And when I was younger, you know, you go through naughty stage and a good stage and then all those kind of things. But where do they take a rugby club to Verbier or to Munich Beer Festival or to Miami on RV trips? So for me, it's if my life, if I see what I want to remember, what if I think I'm on close to death and I'm lying in the hospital, the only thing I can take with is my memories. Well, I've got my memories of my family and friends and what they think of me. I mean, I can't take any material things home. And I want to say when I'm there, I want to say I've had a good impact on people's lives. And, you know, I lived fully. I don't want a lot of regrets when I'm there.
No, sure. And do you know what? I can't imagine anyone be saying that about you, matey. Like, I even just talking to you now, I'm like, just get this wave of positive energy and good vibes, and my sister has spoken so highly of you, so there's no way that anyone's coming out with anything but positivity around you. The other thing I would say is that I think one of the things you touched upon is the lack of media exposure and young players coming through today. I wonder, do the clubs and do the international setups, do they take players' mental health a lot more seriously these days? And do they have things in place to help with that management of being so scrutinized by the public?
I think there's still a lot of growth, Rob, to go from that perspective. Only now, I mean, if you take mental health, if you take concussions, if you take all those kind of things, they were sort of brushed over because you can't see it. You can't see when someone is, well, you can see if they're unhappy, but I mean, if someone's got a concussion, myself as well, we played many times with concussions and didn't actually know the dangers of doing that. You don't want to let your team down. You don't want to let the coach down. And you are not always truthful, rightly or wrongly so, in that age or time, being that young, because you want to be liked, you want to perform, you want to keep your place in the team. And I guess, you know, the older you get, the more relevance you get of how important rugby really is. And mental health, it's definitely, you know, it's the one thing I can say professional sport that is very challenging, and you learn how to cope with that. And I wasn't one of the players that always got picked, wasn't always in the first team. I sat on the bench a lot. Is actually the ups and the downs, you know, being selected the 1 week, not being selected another week, you know, and it's quite a mental challenge, and getting feedback every week from where you are. Did you play well? Didn't play well? Or the lack of that, you know, where you're uncertain of where your position is. I think you start then to focus, and that's what the sports psychologist always said, always try to focus on what is in your control. Now, that's a big thing, is you can look at it, every failure as a positive or negative. I just saw, okay, fine, it's a great time to grow. If I wasn't selected, I would also coach, man, what can I do to be selected? And then I will go to the other players and, or the other hookers and go, well done, I actually want to wear your shirt. It doesn't make me less competitive, but how can I help you be great this weekend? Because very different individual sports to team sports is you want your team to do well. And that's the big thing about the Springboks here in the World Cup. Irrelevant if you play 1 minute or every minute, you get paid the same. So for me, it's beneficial. If the team does well, then I'll do well. And that is, I think, the amazing thing about team and diversity of a team. As I saw through the Springboks, that we are such a diverse group of individuals, that if we all bring that collective IP together, we can do something amazing, because our backgrounds is different. I mean, our color is different. Our language is different. We are different kind of players. We bring so much different mix to this amazing recipe, you know, so much spice, that eventually it was, okay, let's throw all the spice together. Let's see what comes out of here. And it was really magical.
You mentioned the team, the sports psychologist. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about, I mean, you don't have to go into too much detail, but it'd be interesting to know what the purpose of that was, and did you find real value in it?
Yeah, so, okay, as a young kid growing up, sports psychologist was mostly just to sort of prepare you. This is not a Springbok kind of 19 and 21 kind of thing. And luckily, through my whole career, there was always sort of a sports psychologist somewhere mixed in. My first years at the Lions, Doc Yanni or Dr. Yanni, he was always there sort of managing things, but it was more of a team environment. You know, how can the team function? And there wasn't a lot of focus on the individual, but you were always open to go and discuss things with them. As a younger player, you don't really want to tell the team psychologist everything. Then at Saracens, once again, then you go to Saracens, there was, okay, fine, here is a team psychologist, but our focus is actually to add value to you as a product. What are you going to do after rugby? If there's any other problems, go talk to him. But we call it personal development program. What do I want to do after I'm playing rugby? So they try to add value to the product some other way. Rusty didn't really have any sports psychologist in. He just focused purely on player welfare. So it's someone from player welfare in that sort of focus on the bigger picture. And then for him, it was always no egos. You know, it's not about you. It's about us as a team. And that was very, very interesting as well. But luckily, you know, I think there was probably a debate of what players to take and what players not to take. But he said, well, if I would always take a guy that will sacrifice for the team before just himself, you know, it's not about the eye, like everybody says. But yeah, so from a sports psychologist perspective, it's always nice to have someone to talk to that is not always in the environment. And I've always said, I mean, even before I got married, it's always good to have someone external to talk to and bounce ideas off and give advice. And yeah, it's always, you can't always go to your mom or your dad to talk about the relationship, or, I mean, they inherently will pick my side sometimes, or pick my wife's parents will pick her side, kind of thing. You need someone totally independent. Maybe bring up different ideas, different solutions. Yeah.
I think that objective point of view is so important. Like, I've recently booked myself back in to go and see a psychologist just because some things cropped up from remnants of what happened last year. And I was like, nah, not prepared to go down this route again. Was straight back in to see the doctor, straight back down the, okay. Even if it's just a mental check-in, I think that that is so important. I guess what I'm sort of ushering you towards.
Sorry, just on that. It's like seeing a dentist. Do you hold yearly check? Good check. Yeah, it should be, but it's never been seen. If you see a psychologist or if you go see someone with your wife, there's problems. There's always problems. Everywhere the perception is that there's problems. But it's actually just a good way of maintenance. I mean, you're not going to go to, for example, I don't know, if you're going to run, if you're a sprinter, you need to train, you have to do things in between. Maybe it's a bad example, but you have to go and see someone the whole time, not the whole time, to check in like a dentist. Every now and then, make sure your teeth is clean, the heart.
Oh, hang on, buddy. One sec.
Get relevance and where you are.
Sorry, mate. The internet here is a luxury commodity and it sometimes just disappears on you. So I think I absolutely hear what you're saying. I think the analogy that I like to use in this scenario is the way that you would have, like, I think Osha, who I interviewed for the season one, he gave the analogy of you'd take your car in for a checkup, wouldn't you? You'd go and get it serviced every so often, just on principle, because you might not be an expert on cars, but you know fundamentally that in order for the car to not have its wheels fall off and the engine fall out on the highway, you go and take it in and you get somebody to look at it and they service it and then you're off again on your travels. Yeah. And I think that that's the way people need to look at their mental health. I know I certainly do. And obviously different strokes for different folks. Like some people, and I think that that's what this is all about. It's about people feeling confident and comfortable enough to, whether it's going down the route of seeing a psychologist, that's at this sort of end, the pointy end, if you like. And then before that is just having the confidence to actually say to someone, because I know from my point of view, I don't have perhaps the same relationship that you have with your parents, whereby you feel like you can go and talk to them. I am still a very irresponsible old man who doesn't have a wife or children. Like, you have these amazing support networks that are in immediacy to you, whereas I don't. So for me, thinking that I was emotionally articulate last year and then just realizing when I hit the absolute wall was like, oh God, like, I don't know how to talk to my mates. I don't know how to talk to my family. Help! And just self-destructive, basically. So I think that the more we can do to help guys who would look up to you as, you know, when I told a few people that I was interviewing you, they went, bloody hell, he's a big lad, isn't he? I was like, yeah, he's a big lad. He's a big lad. But they were genuinely like, okay, well, this is the kind of, I've found that in terms of trying to change the perception of masculinity, it's about people like yourself willing to just be like, let's have a chat. Let's have a chat about ego. Let's have a chat about, and this is where I was leading to with the idea of psychologists and being, you know, open about your experience is vulnerability. Now, how important is it to you as somebody that's been in the public eye, as somebody that has children, how important is it to you to be seen as vulnerable?
Very important. Well, to say the least, you can see vulnerable in a different way. People see it as maybe not crying. For me, I watched the movie about Bradley Cooper. I can't remember Bradley Cooper with
Is it with Lady Gaga?
Lady Gaga.
That one. A Star is Born.
Yes.
I'm embarrassed to know that.
Now imagine this, right? So it's just before Test against New Zealand in Wellington. Of course, I'm not going to say what player I sat next to, but we're sitting there watching this movie on a Friday night before the game. Of course, this is, I get quite involved with movies and any kind of emotions. I cry hard when I cry. I laugh hard. I'm out there. I'm out there. So, of course, Bradley, sad ending. But I can't believe I'm devastated. But I am crying like I've never cried before. The player next to me goes like, what's wrong with this guy? So for me, it's like the same with my kids now. If I go out and I'm happy, I'm happy. When I'm sad and something bad happens, I cry a lot. Now, for me, it's important to show to my boys, and I'm referring to my sons, that they can be happy. They can be sad. It is okay to show weakness. It's okay to show happiness. It is just live in the moment, you know. It's in essence, I guess, everyone's born with different skills, different self-esteem, different, we're all different. And it's okay, it's great to be different, you know. People ask on rugby, I said, I don't know. They can do whatever they like. They're their own creatures. You know, if they want to be a ballerina or a cricket player or a accountant or a lawyer, it's not for me to decide what they want to become. I'm there to support them and love them. That is my role, you know, and I'm happy with that. You know, but for me, vulnerability is sometimes hard when, especially in a game, for example, I can take it back to rugby when, you know, Blatter now has got my number in the scrum. I mean, it is important to say to your teammate next to you, listen, buddy, help me. This guy is weighing 15 kilograms heavier than I am. He's got my number and he's going to break my ribs if I don't do X, Y, Z, you know, kind of thing. And because I wasn't always the biggest guy when it comes to rugby, I had to improvise, you know, from a technical perspective, I have to scrum in a different way. I had to use my loose head and tights to help me out. I'm not like John Smith that can just all Pilates and I'll take the grunt of the whole scrum, you know.
Take the full weight of the pack on their shoulder.
Yeah, well, that's why I was actually supposed to be right about 1.63 and I only ended up being 6 just because I can't, you know, I've been pushed in a box my whole life in the scrum. I've been like a squeeze quite a bit. But yeah,
all right, 6 foot's good, man. Six foot's fine.
Well, technically, I'm not 6, but to be honest, that's a mental thing. I'm 181, that makes me what 5'11.
5'11, yeah. Yeah.
So, anyway, so for me, and that's a good thing is when you build relationships. Valuable relationships. It's always great in sharing not just your strength but your weaknesses, and that's really great friendships. You know, it's for me. I've been lucky, and for me, it's investing in friendships that makes it special because I don't know, people makes me tick.
I think I was trying not to fist pump too wildly, but I was doing it outside of your view. But I just fucking love that you have told me that story. And I love that you are having those conversations with your lads, because I have just through the natural course of doing this podcast and meeting different and exposing myself to people that perhaps normally wouldn't, and taking a more conscious role to talk to men and boys who I probably wouldn't normally, is so, so, so pleasing. And so, and it's given me goosebumps as you're talking, that, you know, someone like yourself who would be considered a manly man is out there and you're not afraid to say, yeah, do you know what? Vulnerability, sensitivity, having a good cry, it's actually fine. There's no harm in it. And in fact, showing that weakness will actually give you strength. And I fucking love that shit. So one of the other, I just want to bring it back ever so slightly. You mentioned that you're the unnamed South African colleague, you know, gave you a bit of a look of what are you up to. Yeah. But do you think that the tide is changing in terms of how, I don't want to just say rugby players, because I even in the circles that I used to revolve in, I remember, here we go, here's a rugby story for you. I know not to look at me, you'd think rugby player, but I did play for 16 years, sir. Yeah. And I played at a fairly decent level. People will laugh at that, but we did. Our school team, my college team, and my university team were all pretty good standard. And while we were at school, we got taken to Canada to go on a rugby tour there. And we were playing against lads who were like 17, 18, 19 years old, and we were all like 14, 15, so still in that developmental stage. And I remember one game, we were battling, and it was getting really quite violent. And I remember just being so overwhelmed with emotion that I just cried on the pitch. And expecting to get completely rinsed by my mates for it. And my mate, Sam Carter, who was the captain, he just came over to me, put his hand on my shoulder and said, don't worry about it. It's just a game. And I wonder if you think that the tide is changing for men in general. Do you think that we are becoming a more sensitive breed of human?
If I look at it from my perspective, my experience, and perception, really, that's actually what it is. Back in the day, the perception is show no weakness, be hard, don't cry, figurehead of a family with no weakness kind of thing. Where I think it's the perception of where it is now, and I'm very lucky. I've seen my dad cry, being a very emotional. And not always everyone's got that same sort of data, if I would say. But I guess from a team perspective and from a male perspective, I can see that type changing. Mm. Not just that, but it's accepting differences. Everyone had to be in a certain way. Now it's more open to be whoever you want to be, you know, and rightly so. I mean, more women rights, more accepting different sexes. It is, for me, it's just being yourself. You don't have to be pushed in a box and be a certain way and conform the whole time. The big question is, how do you treat people? How do you, you know, and that's sort of the essence of everything, irrelevant of what you are, what you think you are. It's how you treat other people that people remember.
I hear what you're saying. I would challenge you in a sense of, I think that, as we said before, like you've managed to go through a career at the highest level without the kind of perhaps the same scrutiny as players today. I think that perhaps there is that more work can be done. And I think that the clubs, as you say, like the clubs and the international teams really need to. And it'd be nice to see more done in that space for rugby players, because I certainly don't think at the moment there's quite enough being done. Now,
but Robert, sorry, just on that, it starts at home. Before you become a rugby player, before you become a cricketer or swimmer or an accountant or a lawyer or whatever you are, I think if you can, there's a great book, Raising Boys. If you understand the different stages of boys, and as a parent and as a dad, invest in your boy, your son, development, and irrelevant of what he picks, know that he's got a loving father, and that's not always the case because people grow up without dads, without role models. It's for me easy to say, but I think if you can, and you're in a situation where you can add value, and the hard part for me is so I'm sharing this is now when you normally between your 30s and 40s, that's the most important time for to spend time with your kids. But now I'm trying to forge a career where time is constrained, and that's where society, it makes it very difficult. Do you then rather provide as a dad? And I think that's what, if you look back to all the dads before that, where it wasn't a dual income, I think where they felt they had to provide for the family, make sure there's financial security at the cost of spending time with their kids, boys and girls. And that's what makes it tricky, where there was always a perception that either one, the mom must stay at home. Now you've got the mom and dad working, maybe a nanny or caregiver looking after the kids, but the kids actually want to spend time with their parents. And that's why you have kids, is to spend time with them. And that makes it quite tricky from a society perspective. I don't have an answer, but I can, now that I'm in the corporate life or the working environment where I'm not a rugby player, I can understand that challenge as a parent. You know, you want to provide for your kids, give them a great grounding, but at the same time, there's work commitments and you want to move up the corporate ladder, I guess. And I don't understand the balance. I'm trying to find my own feet, but it's hard.
Yeah, man. And it's, I don't want to say it's wonderful to hear, but it's reassuring to hear that someone like yourself, who's been to the top and experienced success at the highest level and is the thoughts of the everyday man, you know, the thoughts that we all go through, which is those base emotions of, yeah, I just want to be a good person. I want to provide for my family. Like, you know, everyone goes through that. I think that that's, as I say, it's quite reassuring. I would quite happily sit here and talk to you all day, to be honest. But at some point, I've got to give you back to your work and probably your family. But just out of interest, how did you stumble upon my sister? I think that's a question that needs answering. She seems to know a lot of rugby players. I don't know if that's I should be concerned about.
A friend of a friend during a Barbarian international game against Wales or England, I think. Okay. But the bigger question, Rob, on this is, how do you live in Australia and don't have an Australian accent yet?
I have worked very hard to bring a proper English accent to Australia. Look, I've only been here 10 years. I have a very neutral...
Only 10 years.
It'll be 10 years in January. I arrived on Australia Day 10 years ago. So it really was a good day to celebrate the arrival of a foreign presence. But yeah, like I love living here. It was the real the sort of making of me. I found myself slipping into some probably rather unhealthy habits in London, shall we say. Yeah. You know, just going out and partying all the time and not really having a sense of who I was, and just doing this, you know, getting into a bit of a churn. The opportunity to move to Australia came along. I took it. I came here, and I really feel very happy here. Like, it's such a beautiful country.
It is amazing. I love Australia.
I do miss my family, but you know, they're living their lives, and you know, thankfully technology's advanced well enough for me to see them when the internet isn't dropping out. But yeah, it's good, man. It's good. And where are you in South Africa at the moment?
I'm based in Stellenbosch, the wine route.
Oh yeah, lovely. Yeah, I know it.
Yeah, so well, very close to Cape Town. Awesome spot, awesome people. 15 minutes away from a surf and 5 minutes away from golf and 5 minutes away from mountain biking in the mountains with all friends.
Well, when and if they ever let us out again, I would love to come for a mountain bike with you, because South Africa is very much on my my to-do list. But all in good time. I guess we'll all have to have a largely untested vaccine first, so we can all look forward to growing third feet.
Well, I can say officially you're invited, so it's for you to
Oh, thank you, mate. I really appreciate that. I would genuinely love to come and say hi, and maybe we could do a campfire conversation in person.
Yeah, that would be even better.
Before we wrap up, I wonder if there's one... There's often never a golden bullet to having good or staying, you know, having good mental health or staying positive. Yeah. But have you found that there's a thing or a number of things that have helped you along your way that perhaps somebody listening might be able to take away and apply that to their current struggles?
For me is two things, seeing relevance in what you do. Firstly, there was always talking about Euros, and everyone's got a different way of perception of Euros. So someone told me, close to me, said, Scala, why do you want to try to be like this player? And this was as a kid. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you know, Scala, there is only one Skulk. Be the best Skulk you can be. Why do you want to be a replica of XYZ? Be the best you can be. Now, everyone is given different talents, different ways. And then talking about relevance or your perception on things. So we just played against lesser Tigers that you would know. We prepared the whole week. We did all the analysis. We focused so hard on this game. And then we went and played against them at Vicarage Road. And we got pumped, right? So they were just a better side. So, of course, you are so negative after the game. You trained hard. You practiced hard. You ate, slept for this one game and got pumped. Then the Monday morning we came into the meeting room. Of course, after a loss, everyone is not negative. They are. There's not enough energy in the room. And the coach walked in, Brendan Fenton, and said, guys, thank you. You guys were unbelievable this weekend. And I go, we just got pumped. He said, guys, we just played against a better side. They were better. They've been together longer. Let's learn. They do X, Y, Z better. Let's learn what they do. Why are they so good? And guys, I just want to say thank you for your work rate and commitment. So the only thing as a rugby player, what you can bring is physicality and work ethic. You know, if you then lose after that as a team effort, then you have to look at technical things. But from that perspective, it changed my mind, because he said, guys, look at you guys. You did everything you can. And lastly, guys, I'm a doctor. You are negative about a lost game. I've got kids that's got cancer that probably won't make it to the end of the year. I've got parents that has to say goodbye to their family because they've got X, Y, Z. That is real life problems. When you are on your deathbed, that is problems. Losing a rugby match, guys, it doesn't even scratch the surface. Wake up, grow up, let's get on with it, you know, kind of thing. And from that perspective, well, that changed my mindset. You know, it's sometimes you try the best and you fail, but that's okay. You know, get up and go. You know, it's amazing. That really changed my perception. And then about power is not everyone's got always the mentality to get up and go every day, but truly seeing a guy's character is not when he's always down, because there's only one way up, but it's really when a guy's right at the top. How does he then treat people below him? That is when you really see character coming to the forefront. So that's the two things that always sticks with me. How do I treat people when you actually people below you? And from that's from a team environment. When you are captain, do you still treat the guy that when that the same guy that was you 15 years ago kind of thing? So for me, it's those two or three bullets that I can always say is see in the bigger scheme of things, what importance does it play? Now, how there's only one you, be the best you can be. And when you do have power or you've got status, how do you treat people that are deemed by the public not as important? That is the biggest things I would say that keeps me, yeah.
Absolutely love it, mate. Absolutely love it. It's such a lovely, poignant moment to draw things to a close. As I say, I could quite happily sit here and talk to you all day. I love your energy, mate. I love talking with you. I would much rather us just... in fact, it's so late now, I'm probably not going to get a good sleep, so we could just waffle on some more if you like. But you probably want to get back to your three boys and your wife at some stage. But in all seriousness, thank you ever so much for joining me today on the podcast. It's been an absolute bloody pleasure. Your energy and your effervescence is infectious. It's really, really quite remarkable. And I must thank Fiona for hooking us up.
Thank you, Fiona. Rob, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. And may Christmas and New Year be amazing and 2021.
Thank you ever so much, sir. Let's hope that our paths cross in the not too distant future in the real world.
And to all the listeners, the only reason why I say sir is he's getting skulk and shulk wrong. That's why.
This is conditioning. This is rugby. I still call if I go through, if I just out of complete respect, I just call people sir. I call my boss sir, and I call people when I go and order food at a restaurant. I'll be like, "Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Much appreciated." And it gets a funny reaction here in Australia. You'd be surprised. They often give you one of these, and you're like, "Oh, enjoy it." Anyway, thank you, mate. I'll speak to you again in the near future. Au revoir.
Cheers, man.
Well, there you go, my dudes. I do trust that you enjoyed that. A huge thanks to Skulk for giving up his lunchtime to waffle away with me. As you could probably tell from our ramble, I was quite excited and honoured to spend the hour chatting about his professional career and what tolls that took on him and those around him. It was real bravery, real honesty. It was real nice. As always, I never want to underplay the gratitude for having the courageous conversation, so thanks again, Skulk. Really appreciate it. Listening back to that chat gives me real hope. Hope that people like Skulk have left an important legacy behind them in a sport that is usually dominated by archaic perceptions of masculinity. Hope that as the younger generation of players and men make their way through the tricky minefield of manhood, there's a better blueprint for the ways in which to tackle their emotions and to be successful on and off the pitch. That might seem a little trite, but it's true. As was the case with Nick last week and the Tackle Your Feelings program, we have to start influencing and changing the narrative earlier. A hard but worthwhile goal, in my opinion. Now look, I know many of you turn off around the stage where I ask you to rate and review the podcast, but if you did enjoy the conversation, could you please just take a moment to leave a review on Apple Podcasts? Or perhaps you could follow us on Instagram at GoCampfire. As always, there's no pressure, but it does help get the content into the ears of those who may need it most. Remember, your mental health matters. With the way that the world is and looks to be staying for the short term at least, there's never been a better time to check in with yourself, take stock, reach out, or maybe even have just that first courageous conversation. Wherever you are on the scale, remember, you're never alone, and there's an enormous amount of resources available to you. All you have to do is take that first step and reach out. If you or a loved one is struggling with their mental health, check out gocampfire.co/support for a selection of some of the best organisations out there helping everyone in Australia achieve their very best mental health. Finally, if you'd like to connect with me, hit me up on Instagram at ASAPBobby or via the Campfire socials. And links, as always, are in the podcast description. Well, I'm off to source my next courageous pioneer for you to listen to. But until next time, stay happy and healthy, my dudes!